Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening?
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
And NPR.
You just want to luncheon?
You go first.
All right. Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and today on the show...
Well, this is a whole hour about ghosts. I guess you could call them ghosts, because...
It's more of a haunting kind of show.
Yeah.
Because these are stories of possession.
Yes.
We've got a story of a man whose dreams were possessed by a boogeyman. And then...
A machine that is occupied by a saint.
And then a dead woman who lives on in a form that many of us have sucked on. Really? I mean, it's actually, not in a sexual way, but...
No, not at all.
I want to save your life kind of way.
Right.
And we start with a story that... You know what? I'm just going to read you something.
Okay.
It's from author Mary Roach, and it starts like this. What happens after you die? I can name you 47 men who've tried to harness the rational horsepower of science to answer this most floaty question. Some were physicians, some physicists, some psychologists. Two were Nobel Prize winners. Of them, only one to date has landed irrefutable proof. Man's name was Thomas Lynn Bradford.
Yes.
And that is Mary Roach.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Jed?
I'm good. Mary is the author of several books with wonderfully succinct titles.
Spook, Stiff, Bonk.
Those are three different books. The one we're talking about today is Spook.
The subtitle is Science Tackles the Afterlife.
Which brings us to Mr. Bradford.
Thomas Lynn Bradford was a spiritualist who lived in the early part of the 1900s.
A spiritualist, is that...
Spiritualism was very, it was a religion very popular around the turn of the last century that was predicated on this notion that there is no death, that when you die, you just go on to Summerland.
Summerland.
A beautiful place beyond.
The thing is, spiritualists like Thomas Lynn Bradford, actually especially Thomas Lynn Bradford, they didn't just have faith that Summerland was out there after death. They wanted proof.
Physical evidence that there is a beyond.
So here's what happened. One day, when was this, by the way?
This was 1921.
One day in 1921, Thomas Lynn Bradford put out an ad.
Yes, he put an ad in a Detroit newspaper.
Which basically said, I would like to prove the existence of the afterlife. Anyone out there that can help?
I'm looking for other like-minded people to think about this. And this one woman contacted him.
Really?
A Ruth Moran.
Who is apparently a psychic.
And the two of them sat down and they devised what they thought was an ironclad plan. One person dies, crosses over to the afterlife.
And then from the beyond, that person would yell back.
Hey, it worked. I'm here. There's an afterlife.
Meanwhile, the person who didn't die would be sitting in a room somewhere, psychically listening. To see if they could hear something.
Because if they could, then we'd have our proof.
Huh.
In fact, I think it was that evening, Thomas Lynn Bradford, in his rented room, he turned on the gas. with the pilot off and asphyxiated himself. The New York Times reported this whole thing.
Detroit, February 6th. Thomas Lynn Bradford committed suicide last night. His body was found in his room at 2500 Howard Street with the gas turned on.
The landlord in his building found him the next day.
Nearby were found several typewritten pages on "Can the dead communicate with the living?" Somewhere in Detroit is believed to be a girl who is waiting for him to answer this question.
The girl, of course, was Ruth Moran, the psychic, and there she was, across town in her own small apartment, with the lights off, as I imagine it, just waiting.
Listening. But she didn't hear anything from Thomas Lynn Bradford.
Detroit, February 7th. Though more than 40 hours have elapsed, no message has come back from the spirit world to Mrs. Ruth Doran.
There was a follow-up story the next day. The headline said,
Dead spiritualist silent.
It was almost like when somebody is lost at sea. They wait a certain amount of time, and then they finally say, okay, we're declaring him dead.
Yeah. But you know what's weird? Is like this Ruth girl, right? Why wouldn't she just lie and say that she did hear Thomas Lynn Bradford?
I know, that's...
I think it's very admirable to be honest like that.
I think that people like Thomas Lynn Bradford and Ruth Moran, they weren't trying to pull a hoax. They weren't charlatans. They really were just seekers. They really just wanted to find proof.
Huh. But you say, you said in that thing I read, you set him up as being the guy who knows, the guy who found proof. Were you just being colorful when you wrote that?
No, I mean, he knows in that he's dead now.
Oh, I see.
Dead people know.
So this isn't really like a knowing problem. It's a journalism problem.
It's a reporting problem. Billions of people know. They just can't get the answer back to us.
Huh. Okay, that brings me to my last question. In your book, Spook, in the dedications, you say, to my parents, wherever they are or aren't. At this point, after writing this book, are you willing to say that they are somewhere or that they aren't?
If I had to put my money on it, seriously, if a great deal was at stake and I had to decide one way or the other, I would put my money on they aren't anywhere. But that's really depressing, and I don't want to have to put my money on it.
Yeah.
And I don't like to be the sort of person who even says that, because, you know, my mother believed. My mother absolutely had faith that when she died, she was going to heaven. And even if she's wrong, she doesn't know she's wrong. So she went through her whole life with a calmness and a peace of mind that I'll never have. The people who believe win. The skeptics lose.
Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. That's good enough for me. Well, it's good enough for my grandpa.
Thanks to Mary Roach, author of the book Spook, and many others.
That was good enough for my grandpa. That's good enough for me.
Our next story is a little different. Now, we've just met a person who couldn't come back. This is a woman who did make it back from the other side, but in a very strange form.
You've probably seen her.
Really?
You've seen her face.
Oh. Comes from our producer, Sean Cole.
You may have even
dated her.
Well, put your mouth on her.
Explain.
So, you know when you got to bring somebody back to life?
One, two, yeah. Three, four.
They make
five,
you take a class.
Six,
yeah.
And
eight,
they make you practice on this dummy.
CPR, yeah.
And the dummy has this face.
That you suck on.
Well, you don't suck on it. You blow into it.
That's what I meant.
You don't know a lot about CPR.
No, right. Well, what's the story with the dummy?
So that lady.
28, 30.
Before she was a dummy, that face belonged to an actual woman's face.
The CPR dummy's face is an actual lady?
An actual lady that was transfixing and inspiring to millions of people and used to basically hang out with Napoleon and Mozart.
Come on.
True.
Yes.
I first heard this story from this guy, Jeremy Grange.
I'm a producer with BBC Radio in the UK.
He made a documentary about all of this a while back. But basically, our story starts in Norway in the early 1950s. There was this toy maker named Asmund Lærdal.
I mean, Asmund Lærdal was making plastic toys, brightly colored toys.
And this story also involves
his two-year-old son, Tore.
I'm Tore Lærdal.
He's all grown up now.
Well, obviously, I don't recall the details myself, but it's been told to me that
he and his father, Asmund, are at their summer home, which is on the ocean. And somehow, Tore toddles his way out of sight, and the next thing anyone knows,
I was found floating face down in the sea. And I was just kept floating by some air trapped in a raincoat.
He's on top of a raincoat on the water?
So I think the raincoat is on top of him, but basically it's keeping him aloft.
So there's a bubble of air underneath.
Yeah, and then Asmund, his dad, sees him.
I don't know how long I have been in the water, but when I was pulled out by my father, I was lifeless.
And not only does Asmund not know mouth-to-mouth resuscitation.
This was in 1954.
There is no mouth-to-mouth resuscitation.
I mean, no, people didn't know about it.
It hadn't really been developed yet. And so his dad,
he was shaking me and
doing whatever he could.
Gradually, I responded.
And as fate would have it, not long after that, Asmund, having freshly saved his son from drowning, is contacted by the man who is developing mouth-to-mouth resuscitation.
An Austrian doctor called Peter Safer.
We had worked out all the basics of CPR with the mouth-to-mouth and the compressing the chest and everything like that, but
he realized he needed a way for people to practice this. And
my father was asked whether he possibly could help making some kind of training device.
And pretty quickly, Asmund thought, well, we need a dummy.
And Asmund had to decide what the face of this dummy was going to look like.
Should it be a woman? Should it be a man?
I think he felt that people would be more intimidated or shyer if it was a man's face, so he decided to go with a woman's face.
An attractive woman's face.
Because at that time, you were asking lay people to blow into a quote-unquote dead person.
You know, you don't want to blow into somebody who's gaping with a horror face. She should look comfortably dead.
And then he came across this girl in my grandparents' home.
Asmund is there in the house, and he looks up at the wall and sees this face of a woman. It's a mask.
And my father was taken back by the beauty of this face.
And he says, that's the face I'll use.
This was a mask? So what kind of mask was this?
It was a death mask.
What's a death mask?
All right, I'm gonna go back even further here. So stay with me for a minute. Back in the 19th century, commonly people after they were dead, they'd have masks made of their faces because you want to preserve their countenance. So right after the person dies, pretty much, you take a bunch of clay and you stick it on their face and you make a mold, fill the mold with plaster, and then you've got a plaster mask and you can reproduce it. It was especially common in Paris.
Hey, Radiolab. It is a sunny, cold Paris October morning. And
of all these mask makers workshops that existed around Paris 120 years ago, there's only one left.
And we're about to visit
called
Lorenzi's, which is a mask making shop. So I'm coming up to the gate.
We asked our friends Kristen Clark and Tamara Sredojevic to drop by there for us.
They've still got this incredible workshop, and you go up some rickety, narrow wooden stairs, and you get to the top, and there's just banks of faces.
Rows and rows of people that look like they're sleeping.
Death masks of
who is the one at the top there?
Everybody. No, Napoleon.
Napoleon here.
Where is
Robespierre.
Robespierre, he was in the French Revolution.
Mozart and Beethoven.
That's the mask of Chopin, the composer.
Looking at you from the wall and from the ceiling.
I mean, all of their eyes are closed.
Face after face after face.
And they're all famous.
Historical figures. But also among them is
this girl. She's not a poet, she's not a conqueror, she's not anybody.
Well, she's got to be somebody. I mean, who is
well,
she?
Well, The story that emerged after she died, and this is maybe fact, but the sources are lost to us, so we're not sure exactly what happened. But she was young.
You know, in her early to mid-20s, came from the countryside.
Not from Paris.
You know, she was a sort of poor, uneducated woman, but she came to Paris.
Meets a man.
And there was a love affair.
Which then turned sour.
The story is that maybe she was pregnant and abandoned, or maybe she was just abandoned.
She goes to a bridge that's stretching across the Seine. Might be the one by the Louvre. Steps to the edge.
And she threw herself into the river. And she drowned. And then the body was recovered.
She was taken to the morgue, which wasn't that far away. And in those days,
bodies would be displayed behind glass. And hopefully their relatives or their friends would come along and say, yes, that's my father or my sister or my daughter. And she was this particularly beautiful corpse, and everybody rushed down to see her. And eventually the guy who ran the morgue took a plaster cast of her face because she was so beautiful.
He was just struck by her, just like Laerdal, just like everybody.
So, what did she look like?
Yeah.
I wouldn't say a sort of plump face, but a rounded face.
She's lovely, but not in a come-hither way. She's more like sort of weirdly saintly looking.
Like she's serene?
Innocent, maybe.
Serene, innocent, but also sort of knowing. And she has
a little smile. If you look at the mask, there's just this little smile playing on the lips. And it's just enough to kind of make you think, well, why is she smiling?
And
who is she? And
the problem was,
she wasn't identified.
Oh, so they didn't know.
No. And so ultimately, people started calling her by this name.
The Anconu.
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 What does that mean?
Well, so you know, like the word ingenue, which means innocent lady, like the character of the ingenue in the movies. This is l'Anconu, which means unknown woman.
The Anconu de la Seine, the unknown woman of the Seine. And then gradually, the plaster cast worked its way into the mask maker's workshops and out onto the streets of Paris.
And it wasn't long before this woman became a sensation. And everyone started writing about her.
The face of the young drowned woman,
Rilke,
was beautiful because it smiled so deceptively as though it knew.
Anais Nin.
The woman who had drowned herself here years ago and who was so beautiful that
Nabokov.
Touchingly frail young shoulders.
Who wrote this entire poem sort of demanding, you know, who made you jump?
Who was he?
What, you know, who was the guy?
I beseech you, tell me your mysterious seducer. Was he some neighbor's curly-locked nephew of the loud tie and gold-capped tooth?
In any case, this mask is a huge deal and all thousands, countless people have it hanging on their wall. The same way you would hang Napoleon on your wall because he's Napoleon. Yeah. But they don't know who she is, and that's sort of the point. They're like, who is she? And everybody's captivated, including our toy maker, Åsmund Laerdal.
He felt that the Anconu,
the attractiveness and the story,
would be the right model to use.
For the first CPR mannequin in history, who has a name?
Ressusian.
Could you describe what we have in front of us here?
Well, what we see is the very first production model of Ressusian from 1960.
She's had to check, the face has changed slightly, because if you want to do CPR, you have to have an open mouth. So regrettably,
the slight smile is now parted. Yes.
But you've still got the high forehead and the closed eyes.
Wow.
And
every Ressusian CPR mannequin that's produced.
300 million people have been trained on this thing since it was first introduced in 1960.
Has the face of the Anconu.
Still.
And hopefully, she's looking quite attractive.
4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18,
the craziest part about it is that this face of this drowned woman becomes the face that people blow into to learn how to save drowned people. So it's like,
one, two, three,
it's like
four,
over
five,
and over
six,
and
seven,
over
eight,
again.
One, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14,
thousands
16,
and thousands 16, of people are trying to bring this woman back to life.
That's kind of beautiful.
That's kind of nice. Yeah.
The only issue maybe like is like every fact you've just given her isn't really a given about her. Isn't
yeah,
really a
what
fact.
What do we actually know about this woman?
Well, so I mean, Jeremy went into his research sort of asking the same question. Well, what do we
really know?
What do we really know? What's true?
I have a horrible suspicion. The truth, you know, is that she didn't die.
What?
I mean, having shown the mask to Pascal Jacquin, who's a member of the Brigade Fluviale.
This is the river police whose job it is to pull dead bodies out of the Seine and rescue people from the Seine. And Pascal is in charge. So
he's seen, you know, hundreds of drowned bodies. He can look at a face and he can know whether that's somebody who's drowned.
And he said,
it's surprising when I saw the picture to see that so peaceful face, just because everyone we found in the water, it's never so peaceful.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but when somebody's drowned, they start decomposing quite quickly.
They are swollen most of the time, so
the features that you would have seen in life don't really last very long.
It's not so nice looking
once somebody's been in the water.
Do you think she's attractive?
Yeah, yes, of course, yeah, yeah. Just she looks really graceful.
So if she didn't die, then
Who was she then?
She may have been a model that somebody just thought was pretty, wanted to take a plaster cast of her face. I mean, it's really at that point, it's anybody's guess.
We don't know this?
This is our end of knowing.
It's our end of knowing. Well, it's frustrating.
But maybe it's better that way. I mean, if you don't, like, the reason why she was so captivating is because people don't know and they can just fill this gap with their own stories. They can just sort of sit there and muse about her. In fact, Jeremy told me this story about this museum that he went to in Liverpool. It was at the historic house of a photographer there. And
in the kind of waiting room, there was the mask of the Inconnue actually on the wall there. So, you know, slightly disingenuously, I asked the guide, oh, what's that? Now?
Very disingenuous. Yeah. Well, then you knew everything about it at that point.
I thought I'd see. And it was amazing. She told me this story about twins, two girls from Liverpool. And this is the important bit, from where we were, from the city where we were.
Not from anywhere near
Not from anywhere, exactly. And
the story was almost exactly the same, except this time one of the twin girls left Liverpool in her late teens or early 20s, made her way to Paris, fell in love, got knocked up, the guy left, she despaired, and then
threw herself off the bridge and drowned, and the mask of this beautiful corpse was taken.
But this version keeps going after that. 50 years later, the surviving twin, who never knew what happened to her sister, takes a trip to Paris.
He's walking through the streets of Paris and sees this face on the wall. And yeah, this time, instead of it being her own face, it's the face of her twin sister who's there. And so her twin, who died long before her, is kind of kept forever young while she's had to age. And so she's from Liverpool now, as far as, you know.
As far as the Liverpudlians are concerned.
Yeah.
And I wonder if she's also from Cornwall, as far as the Cornwallians are concerned, and from, you know, like...
Maybe she's a Muscovite, as far as the people in Moscow are concerned.
She's Sicilian, as far as the Sicilians are concerned.
Maybe she's a Laotian, as far as the Laotians are concerned.
And a Buenos Airean.
Maybe Australian.
How about Calcuttan, as far as the Calcuttans are concerned?
Beirutian, as far as the Beirutians are concerned.
Let's go D1. Let's go D in.
Denverite, as far as the Denver people are concerned.
Yeah.
Dalatian, as far as people from Dallas.
Producer Sean Cole. And before we go, thank you to Jeremy Grange and to our readers, Pike Malinowski, Maureen Boudot, and Jeff Spurgeon.
And special thanks to Lisa Morehouse and Michelle Canoe. We'll be right back.
This is Jeremy Grange.
Hi, this is Mary Roach.
And here are the credits.
Here I go. Radiolab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation
and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is produced by WNYC
and distributed by NPR.
End of message.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.